This is an ABC podcast.
Early last year, I got an email from Jamie Fraser. Jamie is an archaeologist, and he was a guest on Conversations a few years ago, and Jamie was inviting me to come and look inside a coffin, an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus. Jamie is the senior curator at the Nicholson Museum at Sydney University, and this museum's got a collection of artefacts from the world of ancient Egypt. And one of those artefacts was this coffin that was previously thought to contain nothing much in particular, but it turned out to be full of surprises. So after the people at the Nicholson Museum opened it, Jamie kindly invited me and my son Joe around for a look inside this ancient coffin, a coffin that had markings on it, identifying it as the final resting place for a high priestess of a goddess called Sekhmet. So we peered inside this coffin, and it was full of debris and bits and pieces, bone fragments, small glassy beads, and a large, heavy lump that looked like a skull, but it wasn't. And the question Jamie and everyone else has been trying to answer was, did all these broken remains actually belong to the priestess whose name was on the coffin? It's some kind of mystery. Hello, Jamie. Welcome back.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me back.
Just first of all, just sketch a bit of a picture of the artifacts that you have at the Nicholson Museum from ancient Egypt.
Yeah, sure. So the Nicholson Museum has 30,000 objects that scatter across the whole Mediterranean world, Europe, Middle East, but a large part of those are Egyptian. And they contain mummies, coffins, bits of coffins, bits of mummies, statues, faience, scarab, amulets, all sorts of things. But a lot of them relate to death because the Egyptians, of course, invested a lot of themselves and a lot of their money into preparing themselves for death. And that translates into artifacts, which then get dug up and eventually come to rest in museums like the Nicholson.
And many of these coffins have intact mummies in them, is that right?
Yeah, so we've got two coffins which were purchased in the 1850s, each with complete mummies inside, and we've got the mummy of a small boy as well, without a coffin, but also complete. But the Menethetes coffin was a little different.
What made you curious about this coffin in the first place?
So the Menethetes coffin is quite a large coffin, sort of anthropoid, meaning human-shaped, but it's not very colourful. So the other coffins we've got on display in the Nicholson are really vibrantly, dynamically coloured. The coffin of Menethetes would have been, but that colour has faded for various reasons. So kind of this nondescript brown with the traces of the decoration on it. So that coffin has been in our education room for some time, where school students can see it, but isn't on display. But it should have had colour and really wonderful hieroglyphs on the underside, but of course it rests on the underside. So it had never been photographed from the back. So what we wanted to do was to jack the coffin up onto some scaffolding so we could actually capture what was on the underside and read the hieroglyphs underneath. But in order to do that, we had to make sure the coffin was empty. And in order to do that, we had to do a little bit of research. And that's when we found that the historical record was a little fluid.
Right. So what did the historical record tell you was in that coffin?
So the coffin had been published in 1940 as part of a catalogue of the Nicholson Museum that the curator did in 1945. And he doesn't talk about the coffin much. He just says, this coffin is empty, or the cedarwood coffin is empty. Whether that means he thought it was empty as in devoid of anything, or empty as in devoid of anything of note or worthy of note, according to someone in the 1940s, we're not really sure. But if you say something's empty, that kind of becomes the accepted wisdom. I mean, never believe anything you read in museums, some would say. I then went back through our database and there was a talk of it containing some mixed debris, so we weren't really sure. And if you had asked me this the day before we took the lid off, what do you expect to find? I think I'd have said, we expect to find nothing. And if you'd said, what do we hope to find? I think I'd have said, I hope that there might be a few residual bandages, a few residual bones that we could perhaps do some C14 dating on or something.
Where was this particular coffin from originally anyway?
We don't quite know because it's been bought off the antiquities market in the 1850s. So that means it's been robbed from the original tomb. But the style of the coffin, the way it looks, the way it's been built, that tells us that this coffin dates to the 26th dynasty. So we're talking about 600 BC, give or take.
600 BC?
Yeah, 600 okay. BC.
So that's before the founding of the Roman Republic, in other words. That's going that far back. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Okay, 600 years before the recorded birth of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Okay. And do we know what part of Egypt it might have been from?
So stylistically, there's been some coffins that look very similar that have been excavated at a cemetery called Saqqara, and that's near Cairo. So, and in fact, Macquarie University in Sydney dug an unrobbed 26th dynasty tomb there about 20 years ago and found a very similar sort of coffin. So I think it's likely that it's from Saqqara. It's absolutely from Egypt, but we're not quite sure.
What do you know about this time that the coffin is from, this era of Egyptian history? This is the late period of ancient Egypt, isn't it?
Yeah, so if you open a textbook, the scholars will call it the late period. I mean, there's not a huge amount of imagination that's gone into that. The more I read about this period, just the more fascinating it seems to me.
Why?
So up until now, Egypt's been ruled for the previous couple hundred years by the Assyrian Empire, so the empire that came marching down out of sort of northern Iraq, Mosul, that area. And then the Assyrians retreat and Egypt is left fending, ruling itself for the first time and what would be the last time for, well, really, in its entire ancient past. So after this period, there's the Babylonians, the Greeks, Persians, all come in and Egypt gets conquered and ruled.
Romans.
But this 26th dynasty is this one kind of last gasp, this last fluorescence of indigenous local Egyptian rule. And what it means to be Egyptian is really being questioned by its rulers, and they're casting back to the glory days of the new kingdom, you know, Tutankhamun and Hatshepsut and all of that sort of stuff. It's like they've read the music, but they haven't quite heard it played. So they're taking these old burial customs and these old temple rituals, and they're drawing on them and building them into the culture of the 26th dynasty, but they're doing it differently. So there's a huge period of innovation as well. And, I mean, think of the Renaissance in Italy, casting back to the classical past, reinventing it for the modern present. And this 26th dynasty period is kind of like that.
It's kind of an old phrase, but it's like the last burst of light from a dying star, in other words. this culture here, and it's trying to remember its former greatness. What's the distance between, for example, the time that this coffin was made and the time of the pyramids, for example?
So the pyramids were built around 2500 BC, and this coffin was built constructed around 600 BC. So that's 2,000 years, give or take. So the distance between us and, say, the birth of Christ is the same distance between Menethetes and the construction of the pyramids. It's a huge span of time.
So the people making this coffin in the ancient world, for them, the era of the pyramids was ancient to them, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, it's this wonderful duality in Egypt. It's both ancient and very contemporary at the same time. The act of mummification and of preserving the body is a hugely ancient act, but it's something that's been survived in various guises all the way through Egyptian history. There's that immediate connection to that ancient past, which in a way doesn't make it ancient. But then these people are walking past the pyramids and these old temples and are very conscious of the heaviness of that antiquity.
We know that for the Egyptians, the afterlife was hugely important, that life on earth they saw just as a blip between the other realms of existence. Why mummification? What did that mean? Did they hope to re-enter the body or something? Why was that so important to them?
Mummification of the body was perhaps one of the most important things that you could set yourself up for the afterlife and in your normal life. So when you die, the Egyptians believed that your spirit, your ba, would leave your body and it would reunify with your body in the afterlife, in this wonderful moment where your physical and your metaphysical body reunite. Dawn is given as this metaphor, often that becomes alive again. So if your body, your physical remains weren't preserved, if your name wasn't preserved, your spirit couldn't find its way back to that receptacle because it wasn't there. They wouldn't know where to go. And so it's literally a fate worse than death. Your spirit would wander the earth, not being able to be born again into the afterlife.
Did that mean everyone other than slaves was mummified?
No, everyone who was mummified was probably quite wealthy because it's a huge process that required a long time with certain rituals, certain rites, a lot of access to different resources. The dead were still buried, even if not mummified officially or properly. it's really interesting here, I think, because there's a kind of feedback in behaviour, because the first mummies that we have from Egypt, the British Museum's got one on display called the Gebelein Man. It's a natural mummification. Someone's been buried in these very dry, desiccated, hot sands of Egypt, and that naturally mummifies the body. So one argument is that mummification happens before the belief of mummification happens, and then the belief kind of hooks back into what's already occurring.
The process of mummification, what was taken out and what was left in?
So every school kid that comes through the Nicholson Museum knows this bit of information, and they love to tell you. The squidgy bits were taken out.
The squidgy bits.
The squidgy bits. So there was an incision made down the person's torso, and the embalmers would remove the lungs, the liver, the kidneys, the intestines. They would put those internal organs, often mummify them separately, and put them in four jars. And those jars would then be put into the tomb next to the coffin with the mummy inside. The brain was taken out as well. But for the Egyptians, your consciousness, your morality, that wasn't from your brain, that was from your heart. So the brain, your nose was broken, a big hook was inserted through the broken nasal passage into the skull cavity, and your brain was pulled out. The brain wasn't kept, useless bit of organ, there to hold up your skull, feed it to the cat. Your heart, well, discarded.
In theory, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Your heart, however, that was a really important organ, because in order for your metaphysical spirit to then go into the afterlife, you had to undergo a test. And that was your heart being weighed against the feather of truth. And by this, I mean, we've got an image of this on a coffin panel in the Nicholson Museum. It's just so beautiful and so wonderful. But the heart is literally on a set of scales with the feather of truth. And if your heart was found wanting, a devourer monster would jump down with the head of a lion and the body of a hippo and a sort of weird kind of pastiche of evils. And it would devour the heart. And then, of course, your spirit could never be reunified with your body.
That's pretty serious. So what is it? If it weighs heavier than a feather, then you get devoured? Or is that not the point?
Yeah, literally, it's that kind of a very clinical way of assessing morality, I guess. If your heart is heavier, then woe betide.
And I have to ask, did they replace the removed organs with a bit of stuffing? Otherwise, you would have this kind of sunken chest cavity, wouldn't you, on the mummy? That would be a bit weird.
We've been CT scanning a lot of our complete mummies in addition to beneath the test that you said at the introduction. And we're finding that they're doing this just for the ones we have in the Nicholson collection very differently, in very different ways. So the mummy of that small child I mentioned, the organs had been removed and then bandages had been placed in. You can see this in the cavity through the CT scans. Whereas the mummy of an adult woman that we have in the collection, her torso has been stuffed with what looks like sort of very fine clay, which has made it quite difficult to see what's there, actually. You're absolutely right. There are things that then go back in to kind of give the body some substance.
When you talk about the child there, I've just got this ghastly picture in my mind of some grieving people just having to do that for a child.
Oh, the name of this boy is Horace, and I think it's important to say the names. This mummy is just... there's so much grief in this child, and it's really quite affecting. And one of the things that the CT scans have been able to show is that he was missing his front left baby tooth and his adult tooth was about to descend. And everyone as a kid has lost a tooth, and everyone knows that toothy grin that a 6.5, 7-year-old kid would have. And this boy had this when he died. And then you can see the love that's gone into mummifying this boy so that he can live again in the afterlife.
So let's bring it back to this particular coffin then. It's made for the priestess called Menethetes. Mm. How much did the coffin tell you about the person that it was made for?
It's a really good question, because the coffin is full of clues. You've just got to ask the right question in order to unlock what it can tell you. And I guess we're in that process at the moment. So one of the things we did is we wanted to know the type of wood that it was made from. So we took very minute samples of wood from the lid and from the trough, from a carved faceplate that's the face of this person. We sent it to the British Museum, where a senior research scientist there called Dr. Carolyn Cartwright is an expert on wood anatomy. And what she does is she puts these samples underneath a scanning electron microscope and looks at them on a cellular level, basically. And like an animal has a skeleton that tells you what the animal is, wood has that as well. And so she could show quite clearly that this wood was cedar of Lebanon. And so think of the flag of modern Lebanon with that tree, that's the cedar tree. And so this wood never grew in Egypt. It's been grown, cut down and exported from Lebanon, which makes it the most prestigious sort of wood that you could have to make mummy coffins in ancient Egypt.
So what does that tell you something about why it wasn't painted then? Do you think you want to show off the fact you're using Lebanese cedar, or wouldn't have been called that at the time? Does that tell you anything about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason why this coffin isn't painted and the ones in our galleries are very colourfully painted is, well, they both were, but the other coffins we have are made out of a local wood called sort of a sycamore ficus, sycamore fig. It's very soft wood, not as great. So it's had to have been plastered over with some linen and some white plaster. And ironically, that plaster has kind of drunk in the colour and held it fast for the millennia. So they look like they've been painted yesterday, whereas the cedarwood coffin, because part of it is showing off this really prestigious wood, part of it's having the smell of that coniferous wood be all pervasive. And that cedarwood also repels insects. So there's a whole lot of reasons not to cover the wood over.
Oh, so therefore it wasn't as low grade as you thought it might have been then.
The coffin is the highest grade wood that you can have. So this is, you know, your Italian marble kind of gravestone in Rookwood Cemetery. This is the kind of the version for ancient Egypt.
Right, and if you're burying someone in like a solid gold coffin, you wouldn't paint on the top of that either, would you, I suppose?
No. They've painted directly onto the coffin, but what they haven't done is sort of put down a layer of white plaster or a backing. So they've painted the hieroglyphs directly onto the wood, and that grain has then, well, it's faded over time.
And was there anything in the hieroglyphs that told you something about the identity of who the coffin was made for?
Yeah, so we've got an expert on hieroglyphs, a guy called Professor Boyawakinga from Macquarie University, who's translating this very, very carefully at the moment. But one of the things that we can find is the name of this person. That's why we can say the name Menethetes, because that name is written on the coffin. It also gives us her title, which is a servant in the temple of Sekhmet.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. Now, what kind of a goddess was Sekhmet? I've seen a picture of her, and she's got, what, a lion's head or something?
A lioness, head of a lioness. And she's this, I mean, all Egyptian gods are just crazy in the kind of paradoxes that they embody. And Sekhmet's no different. So she's the goddess of pestilence and plague. And if disease is coming through, and we know diseases hit Egypt a lot, we see this in a lot of the human remains that we excavate. That's Sekhmet, that's the anger of Sekhmet. But at the same time, Sekhmet's the protector from disease. So doctors in ancient Egypt were often associated with the temples of Sekhmet. So if you want protection from disease, you also have to make the requisite offerings to Sekhmet.
So then we have to imagine Menethetes then as a priestess in a temple with incense in it, perhaps. It's a stone temple. We can imagine. I'm just imagining all this here with incense burning. She's probably wearing something quite amazing if she's walking around in that kind of a temple, conducting all sorts of important rites to keep the local people safe from disease.
Yeah, when you say priestess, we have to be, it's not quite a sort of 9-to-5 all-pervasive job. So here, priestesses in the temple of Sekhmet, there was kind of on rotation, I guess, that you had a private life. She would have probably been married, she may have had children, and she would have had that private life at home. And at the same time, at certain periods of the year, she would have had duties to do in the temple.
Right, so
well,
she's not a nun or a Vestal Virgin then, in other words.
Would have had a full life like anyone else. But she would have had certain obligations in the temple to have come into this temple of Sekhmet at perhaps certain times of the year. And some of those, as you say, I mean, you imagine the incense and all this sort of stuff. One of the big rites was to play music, to either play music or to sing. And that's to kind of wake the god up or to nurture the god. To do the same thing at private funerals as well as the representative of Sekhmet.
So there you are. You're about to open this coffin, as you say, and while you're trying to damp down your expectations, your hopes are starting to creep up. what did you see once you opened that coffin?
I will never forget this moment till the day I die, Richard. It was just the most jaw-dropping. Silence filled the room. So our wonderful collections management team had lifted the lid off. The coffin lid had actually been cut separately, probably by the tomb robbers. So it slides in and out of the top of the feet of the coffin like a pencil box. So you have to slide it out a bit, and then it has to be lifted up, and then they place the lid on the adjacent table. And, of course, we all peered our head in to see were there a few bits and pieces left. And what we saw was astonishing. What we saw was full, almost to the top of the trough of the coffin in a part of it, with this amazing mixture of beads, bandages, bones, lumps of resin. So resin, this kind of bituminous, viscous liquid, was poured over the mummy as a preserving agent. This then hardens. The robbers cracked through this like a shell, and so lumps of this stuff, it kind of looks like coal, were all scattered there through there as well. Some of the sawdust that I think Nicholson had used to package it before he sent it back to Sydney was still there. Imagine picking up a coffin full of bits and pieces, shaking it above your head like a cocktail shaker, and then putting it down. And that's kind of what we saw.
You mentioned there resin, and I mentioned at the start this great big lump inside there of resin. What was that?
Well, I'm perhaps jumping ahead a bit here, but when we CT scanned this coffin, we saw this lump in the CT scan come up, a very high density object, which is too dense for bone. So we didn't know what it was. But eventually, when we started to excavate, our Egyptologist, Dr. Connie Lord, picked it up and she just went, "Oh my God, I know what this is." And it was an endocast. So resin, that sort of viscous mixture of beeswax and conifer sap and things, is this preserving kind of liquid, like a honey poured over. Embalmers often then poured resin back through that nasal passage into the empty skull cavity, because, of course, they've taken the brains out.
So why do they need to do that if they've taken the brain out?
I think it's, as you say, it's kind of just giving a robustness or extra security to keep the body in shape. And we know that they do this because in CT scans of complete mummies, think the famous CT scan of Tutankhamun, for example, you can see where this resin has settled in the back of this person's head. So imagine Tutankhamun is lying back. The resin is poured into his brain. It pulls into the back of his head with a flat top over the sort of the even surface. So we know that this has happened, but I've never been in a situation where we've actually had the endocast. And the reason why the endocast is here is because the body had been so badly broken about by robbers that the skull is there, but it's in about seven pieces scattered throughout the coffin.
So this resin is like a mold of the interior of this woman's brain case?
And you can see the capillaries, the veins, the impressions on that. The resin itself is black, but it's taken on the whiteness of the bone, so it looks kind of freaky. And you can see the moulding of the head, the top of the spinal cord, all that sort of stuff.
So now we have to talk about how this coffin and its interior stuff, the debris, was obtained. As you say, it comes from the collection of Sir Charles Nicholson. Can you tell me a bit about him, please?
Nicholson is an amazing character who had a really important role to play in early colonial Australia. And I think the Nicholson Museum is kind of a legacy that we've got from him, but he's got a much bigger legacy. So he was born in Northern England around Whitby. It turns out from some research done by my predecessor that it was an illegitimate birth, although to a fairly wealthy family. He does a medical degree in Scotland, and in 1833 gets on a boat and comes out to the colony of Sydney. I think like anyone with a bit of dirty washing to launder, the colonies are a good place to do that. So he comes out actually on the boat of an uncle of his who's based in Sydney. His uncle was a ship's captain and was making a lot of money by shipping out the convicts. So Nicholson turns up, educated man, charismatic man, very bright man. His uncle dies soon after in a shipping accident. And Nicholson becomes a very wealthy man. And you put all of that together in this new colony, and it really is a recipe for success. And Nicholson makes the most of it. So one of the things he does is he gets very active in the political landscape. He becomes one of the first elected representatives on the New South Wales Legislative Assembly. He's a big landowner in Queensland, so he becomes the same thing for Queensland when Queensland's created. And he's one of the founding forces, or the driving forces, behind the foundation of Australia's first university, the University of Sydney, which opens its doors in 1850. And then he thinks that this new university needs a sense of history. And of course, we would say today, well, you know, there's 65,000 years of history right underneath. But for someone of Nicholson's ilk, that's casting back to the Mediterranean and Europe. And so he becomes the first vice provost or vice chancellor and then chancellor. And it's in that role in the 1850s, 1857, 1858. He goes on a trip back to the UK, but he goes via Egypt, the Nile Valley, through the Italian peninsula, and he just goes on a big shopping spree.
What, he's cruising up and down the Nile, is he?
Absolutely, and he's buying antiquities off the market, quite deliberately to donate to the University of Sydney on the condition that they start a museum. A lot of people are doing this on the grand tour of the day, but Nicholson's doing it for a very particular reason, and that's to create a collection for education.
And what was he doing them once he'd bought these things? How did he verify them?
He was quite a learned, scholarly man. So he would, he had a lot of good contacts in the sort of the intellectual world at the time. He could read a bit of ancient Hebrew hieroglyphics himself. So he would do a lot of writing and research off his own bat. One of the first things he did with some of the Egyptian mummies was, before sending them to Sydney, he actually shipped them from Alexandria up to London to get one of the curators at the British Museum to have a look at them. So our first descriptions are by this 1859 curator at the British Museum, who I have to say, now that we're 150 years on, got a fair bit wrong.
Yeah.
And then from there they get shipped out to Sydney. And this is before the Suez Canal, so they've come via the Roaring Forties. And I think the coffin was also put on its head because all the stuff inside slid to one end.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
We were talking before about how Sir Charles Nicholson in the 19th century had managed to procure these extraordinary coffins and sarcophagi going up and down the Nile in sometime in the 1850s or thereabouts. Where would he have got them from there? Would he have gone on archaeological digs to get them? How would he have actually gotten these coffins?
Yeah, Nicholson was probably purchasing it through dealers. So he was quite well connected in that kind of antiquities world of Cairo and Alexandria. So he would have had certain dealers that he would have trusted and procured things from.
In Cairo and in Egypt?
Yeah, Cairo and in Egypt. So he was on the ground there and he would have come and inspect these sorts of stuff. Part of the problem is that Nicholson's archive, because he wrote a lot of this down, but he sent it back to his house in the UK that he went back to after his time in Australia, and that burnt down in 1899. So a lot of this kind of contextual stuff has been lost. So we're kind of looking at it with one hand over our eyes.
So, but he would have been walking into, what, a mummy shop, essentially?
Yeah, so he would have gone into probably a dealer's emporium or a shop. His contact would have said, I think this person's got exactly the sorts of things that you're after, because he would have probably said, I want this and this and this, because he's curating quite carefully a collection. He's quite deliberate in what he's looking for. And so he would have gone into this shop at some point in the 1857, 1858, and looked at this coffin. He would have seen what was inside. He would have known, I think, that it had all this sort of stuff inside it. And the very fact that he still purchased the coffin is quite remarkable, because most tourists buying this sort of stuff then would have said, there's a whole bunch of mess in there, clean it out and put a complete mummy in. They weren't interested in that sort of stuff, but something about Nicholson made him procure that coffin with that stuff inside, and I think it's because he wanted it to go eventually to a university, to a place of teaching and research, and he could see the benefits of it.
Where would the dealer have gotten the coffin from?
That's a good question. We don't know. All this stuff, if by virtue of it being in an antiquity shop in the 1850s, it's been robbed. We just don't know where it's been robbed. Now, we think, because of the style, it's been robbed from a cemetery in Saqqara near Cairo, but we don't know.
Were there teams of grave robbers operating at the time in that part of Egypt?
Absolutely. There were quite professional teams. I mean, dynastic families of tomb robbers teaching from father to son the skills of how to find these tombs and how to excavate them. Really quite active. I mean, this artifact, this Menethetes coffin with all this stuff inside mixed up in and itself is this most remarkable artifact of this period of antiquarianism.
What would they have been looking for, these grave robbers? What kind of jewellery would they have been after?
So they were after, quite deliberately, the small jewels, the amulets, the protective bits of jewellery that would have been woven into or placed within the wrappings of the mummy, often around the throat of the mummy. So you have to imagine that at some time in the 1850s, 1840s, the Menethetes mummy is in her coffin in this tomb with the door sealed. And at some time, that door's been cracked open. You can imagine the light coming in and then these strange men coming in, yanking the lid off, cracking through that shell of the protective resin, seeing the mummy ripping through those bandages, trying to find these jewels and amulets. And that's why it's in such a poor condition.
Oh, right. So the wreckage inside her coffin is largely or somewhat due to grave robbers just pulling the mummy apart, looking for jewellery.
Absolutely, and probably successive episodes of tomb robbing as well, which is why we haven't found many sort of amulets inside, virtually none, because the robbers have taken them all away.
So how certain then can you be that when Charles Nicholson goes to buy the coffin that's built for Menethetes, that it's actually the body of Menethetes inside that coffin?
That, Richard, is the kabillion-dollar question here, because it's really common, particularly at that time, for people to come into mummy shops or whatever and say, I want £100 for a coffin and here's another £50 if there's a really good mummy inside. So the dealers would have gone out the back, found the best mummy, put it in the coffin and just sold it as an ensemble.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happened to one of our mummies that we have in the Nicholson. We've got a coffin and dates to about 700 BC and a mummy that dates to about 100 AD. It's 100 years too young for that coffin.
So the question for you then is that her?
By virtue of the fact that it's in such terrible condition, I think it's likely, because why put all this mixed up debris inside? But we don't know. And anything that would have had her name on it within the mummy, so say a scarab beetle placed over the heart, which may have had the name Menethetes, that's gone. So we've got there's no smoking gun here to tell us it's Menethetes. But there's a whole lot of questions we can ask. So the coffin tells us that Menethetes would have been a wealthy woman. She would have been an adult woman. She would have been a woman. And so are the remains well looked after? Are they for an adult? Are they for a female? If we can start ticking that sort of list of criteria off, we can make the case that actually we do have the remains of Menethetes.
So having opened this coffin and seeing these bone fragments, bits of debris, bandages, beads, all these different bits and pieces lying in there in disarray, what kind of ethical dilemma is there for you and your team in deciding to excavate that and extract what you can, the information you can from that ruin?
We spent weeks talking this over and just considering it from different points of view, because this is the remains of a person. And Menethetes, or whoever it is, would have wanted to have been inside the coffin. That's where they should be and where they were supposed to be for eternity. And who are we to come in and take those remains out of the coffin? It seemed a remarkably presumptive thing to do. We didn't want to do this lightly. So what we thought we would do would be to record the coffin and the contents as best we could to today's standards. And we did this through a number of ways. And only then, particularly after we CT scanned and actually made sure that, yeah, the remains really were messed all about within that lump of stuff. So before we had touched anything, have a look inside through virtual techniques like CT, and only then make the decision to excavate the remains or not.
Well, like I said, I've looked inside this coffin and it looks like it's all been shaken around.
Yeah.
So what obligation do you then have to leave it all shaken around?
Well, I mean, it was quite a legitimate response to put the lid back on and leave it, as curators had done in the past. But eventually we decided that we would excavate. And the reason why was that the coffin itself is not a hermetically sealed vehicle in which to have mummified remains. And in a very humid environment like Sydney, it's not a good long-term storage place. Also, as we were talking before, I mean, it was anathema for your body to be in this condition in the afterlife. So there is nothing we could have done more to those remains than the robbers hadn't already done. But ultimately, it came down to respect, I think. I think we couldn't respect the remains by leaving them there. Once we kind of figured out what it was like, I think we really did have an obligation to remove them, to preserve them as best we could. And ultimately what we'll do once we finish this process is, in correct packaging and, you know, well archival material, place her back inside the coffin so she's back where she should be.
Right. So you'll recompose her as best you can with what you have.
Yes.
In other words. Once the excavation began, how did that proceed then?
So our Egyptologist at the Nicholson, Dr. Connie Lord, took the lead on this because she's been working out in Amarna with an international team digging up cemeteries, and she's got, you know, she's an amazing, amazing excavator for this sort of stuff. So Connie divided the coffin up into segments. She basically divided it into two long ways and then divided it into a series of small segments across the short ways. And the reason why wasn't that so much that the location of everything was important, because the sheer fact that it was all mixed around had lost that locational information. But because we'd done some CT scanning, we knew where everything should be three-dimensionally. And so we wanted to know how to rejoin back the beads, the bones, the bandages from each of those bits into things that we could see from the CT imagery, which meant ultimately we could create a visualization or something that would help us better understand, better display this information.
What were the beads? What was that about?
That was one of the most surprising things about this whole process. When we opened the coffin, we weren't expecting anything cultural. I mean, we were hoping for maybe some bandages. It's kind of like one of those 3D eye puzzles when you sort of look at and then you take it away and realise as it comes into focus, it's, you know, it's a unicorn or something. The more we looked at this lump of stuff in this coffin, we thought, oh, there's a bead there and a bead there and a bead there and a bead there. And there was, well, over 100 beads just on the surface, and that really surprised us. And so when Connie started excavating, we were hoping that maybe there would be several hundred more. And I went in to see how she was going on the very first day when Connie, how's it going? And she went, it's wonderful. We've got over 100 beads. Isn't this amazing? 6 weeks later, as she's wrapping up the excavation, I went in, Connie, how's it going? She said, don't talk to me about beads. 7,148 and we're still going.
Wow. Why so many beads? What are the beads?
So these beads are tiny. They're various shapes and sizes, nothing really larger than your little fingernail at most, but most are much, much, much tinier, less than a couple of millimetres. They're different shapes, disc and tubular and things like that, but they're not beads in terms of, you know, wearing a necklace around or jewellery adorning the body. They're for something quite particular. They would have been strung together as a beaded net, like a shroud, that would have been placed over the mummy as she's laid into the coffin.
Over the whole body?
Over the whole body, yeah. And the variety that we're finding in these beads, from the materials, from the shapes, from the colours that are present, indicates, I think, that this net would have been quite intricate. So we would have had a face woven into it with all the different coloured beads.
Well, like a mosaic, you mean? Or
a bead mosaic, absolutely. Right, yeah. Showing a face, it would have shown probably the four sons of Horus across the torso, which is a very protective thing to have done. It would have been very intricate. And we know from some that have been found unrobbed, the sorts of things that it should look like. We know what the cover of the jigsaw box looks like, but 7,128 beads, I'm not sure we're ever going to get there.
As you're saying this, I'm longing to see this shroud with these images on it, but we'll never be able to do that, will we?
No, I mean, we can look at ones that look very similar and draw the comparisons.
Was there anything completely odd in there that you just weren't expecting at all?
Well, there was the endocast we saw before, which just left us with the hairs on our back of a neck. We didn't find much cultural stuff because all the amulets had been taken away. But there was one really weird thing, and we haven't been able to explain this yet. Maybe we never will. Molded out of beeswax is a perfectly proportioned, perfectly shaped, anatomically correct ear. Just one. Now, maybe there were two and the other one's gone. But that's in there, and we don't know why, whether that was part of a kind of mask that was placed over the mummy, but if so, there's no other evidence for it, or whether it's some sort of symbolic object that she can then hear in the afterlife or something. We don't know.
Or what about a prosthetic? Maybe she had some strange accident and lost an ear and they wanted an intact-looking corpse. Is that possible?
That's absolutely possible. I hadn't thought about it, but I'm going to write that down. Yeah, I mean, I think all bets are off with this one. We don't know.
I mean, it seems unlikely. It's not like, oh, yeah, what happened to you? Oh, I lost my ear in a bizarre freak industrial accident. But that it seems unlikely, yeah. But maybe it's possible.
Who knows what went on in the Temple of Sekhmet?
That's fine. Just so long as I can get all the credit for that theory, that'll be great, Jamie. Thank you for that. So, like you mentioned there, you brought the mummy in for a CT scan. What is that, like in a hospital, you mean? Like where patients go?
Yeah. Absolutely. So we partnered with Macquarie Medical Imaging. So they're up on the north side of the Harbour Bridge. We're off on the south side in the Sydney University. So one Sunday, we packaged up the coffin in a crate and we took our three complete mummies in at the same time. And in a big vehicle with some professional heavy movers for this sort of stuff, drove ever so carefully over the Sydney Harbour Bridge off to Macquarie Medical Imaging.
Not too many bumps, yes.
And it was a Sunday because they didn't have patients in that day. It was a day then when the kit was free and we could use it. And we literally wheeled the coffin out and took her into the loaded her or the coffin onto the gantry of the CT scanner, and it went through that big donut ring with the crosshairs of that red laser that you know from CT all the way through, and it was the most amazing thing to see.
I hope anaesthetists didn't get claustrophobic like many people do when they go through this sort of thing. So this is like the CT scan does this thing like virtual salami slicing of whatever it is that's going through it. What did you see in these salami slice pictures?
The big driving question here for us was, we had two things. One was to create this kind of 3D roadmap of what was there to help
whether make the decision whether we do excavate or not, and also to record that for forever as best we could. And part of that was to see, well, how disturbed are these remains? They look disturbed, but are they actually quite well preserved underneath? In which point do we just excavate to that point and stop? And so as the body or the coffin's going through these salami slices, as you say, are flashing up on the monitor, and you know all of us are crowded around. You can get a lot of people around one monitor if you breathe in. And it's showing as these slices go through that, yeah, everything is just mixed up. And then something started to come into focus. It started quite big, this kind of ovoid layer of wrapping that kind of crystallized. It came smaller and smaller and smaller. And then suddenly 10 perfectly round circles appeared on the screen. And they were her toes. Her feet were intact. And since the excavation has gone on, we've seen why. And as the robbers have torn through this mummy, they've snapped off. It's not a clean cut. It's a snap. They've snapped off her ankles. But because amulets weren't placed around the feet, there was no motivation for them to go and unwrap the feet. So the feet are still perfectly wrapped. But because this coffin has been shifted about and probably stored on its head and all this sort of stuff, those feet are sitting perfectly wrapped up, but against the left shoulder of the coffin. So they're in completely the wrong place.
Oh, that's so poignant. Her broken feet are
and
still there.
They're beautiful feet. They're really well preserved. My colleague, the forensic anthropologist who's going through the bones, Estelle Laser, she's described them as looking like dancers' feet.
I have to ask, can you see toenails on the toes?
Yeah, we can. So the preservation is really good. And now we need to make the decision. I mean, we've got the option to do some DNA sampling, radiocarbon, all this sort of stuff.
How old is she?
So
when I say old, I mean how old was she when she died? Do we know?
Yeah. The coffin of Menethetes tells us that this lady, this historical figure who worked in the Temple of Sekhmet, would have been an adult. The problem is that because the bones are so disarticulated, it really is this kind of jumble sale, it's hard to get a lot of a line on that. So just by the length of some of the long bones, the femurs, the thigh bones and all of that, yeah, this person is an adult. But we don't know how adult she is. The teeth are pretty worn down. Now, not all the bones are there. So as the robbers have gone through, they've clearly been chucking stuff away or even taking out lumps for separate sale. So what's left is only a portion of the skeleton. But when Estella's been laying it out, we can see that parts of the whole body are still represented. First of all, it showed us that all the bones in there are human. We didn't know that. It showed us that all the bones in there are just from a single individual. We didn't know that either. So these are pretty fundamental questions that we had to establish. And then the next one is that age question. Is this person adult? Yes, this person's adult. How old were they when they died? We're not quite sure, but the teeth are really ground down. Now, that was quite common in ancient Egyptian life because a food staple was bread. And bread, of course, is from wheat, and wheat would be ground up between lumps of stone. So their bread, we know, was full of grits. And so that's had a terrible, terrible dental health effect for the ancient Egyptian population. And so you can see this in Menethetes' teeth as well, or whoever's they are. But the fact that they're so ground down, I think, indicates that she's probably a mature adult who's been living for some time. When I say mature, I mean probably over the age of 25, given the average age of life expectancy in Egypt was somewhere between 30 and 35. We don't quite know where in. But
you say the priestess in this temple would not have been a full-time position. It's not a nun. She's not that a Vestal Virgin. She's not that kind of a person. Mm. And that this is a pretty much like an honorary position. Everything I've read about the ancient world suggests is that women never got honorary titles until they were of a mature age. Until then, though, while they were still sexual beings, they were treated as something that needed to be carefully repressed and contained in the ancient world. It's only when you get past menopause that women can suddenly be called the mother of the nation or called a high priestess or given all these honours. So maybe that, I'm just riffing here, Jamie, but that just seems to accord with how honours were handed out in the ancient world and probably the modern world too to some degree.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just ultimately don't know when she entered that temple. There's so much to her life that's just going to remain a mystery, unfortunately.
And you are sure she's a woman?
We're not. And this is the big final question we have to answer, because if these remains belong to Menethetes, yeah, they should be female. The problem is because the bones are so badly preserved, we don't quite know. part of that is because the pelvis isn't intact. And of course, it's the pelvis which gives you the best indication. But what we do know is that the skeleton is clearly from the bones, quite gracile, quite light featured. Doesn't necessarily make that person female, but it makes it more likely. The parts of the pelvis that we can look at and analyse indicate likely female, but again, we're not quite sure. And there's a whole lot of these sorts of features that suggest female, but don't prove it definitively.
Right at the start of this conversation, we were talking about the boy you have, the mummy of the boy.
Horace.
Horace, yeah. And you said it was important to say his name. Why is it important to say his name or Menethetes' name?
The Egyptians would have a refrain that was often painted onto their coffins or painted onto the walls of their tomb. And it would be something like, "Speak my name so that I may live again." And I think in this instance, we feel really quite strongly that it's important to speak these people's names of Menethetes and of Horus, because we are making them live again, I hope, in this very different environment, but to give them, or to at least acknowledge that sense of immortality that they wanted.
It's funny, you know, as we're talking about her, I'm kind of enjoying this trip into her world through my imagination, through the kind of things you're talking about. These stories allow people to imagine what that life was like in these faint gleams of this distant past. As we say her name, it makes me wonder if, you know, what she would make of our world, if it could work in reverse and her consciousness could be revived somehow and she could live in this magic land of planes and ultra-fast transport and skyscrapers and...
Well, she would look at living in the Nicholson Museum and see something that's named after someone who lived 150 years ago, and I think that would quite resonate, that sense of wanting to have a mark on the land after you have gone.
When you took me on that trip through the areas where the excavation was being done in the Nicholson Museum, I noticed there was a big packing crate for her. I think that was ahead of the CT scan. And on the big packing crate, there was a little eye of Horus that was painted on there. Is that good luck? Is that what that is?
Not so much good luck, but Egyptian coffins, and it depends on the period, but often had painted this eye of Horus so that the mummy could see beyond the coffin.
Oh.
And so, it goes back to your point of claustrophobia when she's going through the gantry of the CT.
And the drive over the harbour bridge.
The collections management, the guys in the museum who look after this sort of stuff physically, don't want Menethetes or any of the mummies to feel claustrophobic in their case, so they paint on an eye of Horus. I think it's quite important to acknowledge that, whether it's for yourself or whether it's for these ancient people, we're dealing with people here and we have to show respect. One of our wonderful volunteers, a lady called Julie, she sits in our research room at the moment and she's cataloguing every single one of those 7,000 beads. She's just cracked the 4,000 mark and hasn't yet gone insane, but give her time. In boxes next to her are the remains from that coffin that we're looking at before we eventually put them back into the coffin. And every time Julie comes into that room, she turns around and says, "Hello, Menethetes, I'm here again. I'm just going to be looking at your beads again today." And then when she leaves, she says, "Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I'll see you tomorrow." And I think that's wonderful.
I do too. Is that just respect or is there anything more to that? I just wonder how much the superstitions of the ancient world just can't help but seep into the present when you're working on stuff like this, Jamie.
I think we are a very superstitious race, and I think they do seep in all the time. I mean, it doesn't matter, does it, if you can actually hear that thing that goes bump, but the fact that you think you can tells us a lot about who we are and a lot about who Menethetes was.
How creepy is that museum of yours when the lights are out, just quietly?
I've never had any experience, but my predecessor, Michael Turner, who you had on this show some time ago, swears that once... We've got some mummified cats that are up in one of the cases in the Egyptian gallery. And he swears that when he was the last person there to turn the lights off, he went to turn the lights off. And you know the sound a cat makes when it jumps off the sofa or onto the carpet floor in your living room?
That kind of thing.
He swears he heard that sound and he spun around and could see nothing, but it came from that cat case. And he said he locked the doors, he turned the lights off, and he walked away very fast.
Of course he did. What a pleasure it is to speak with you, Jamie. Once again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for the tour, by the way, of the museum and for taking me in to witness the extraordinary spectacle of that mummy and the sarcophagus. And we'll put a picture of that up on the web as well. Thanks once again, Jamie.
Well, thank you.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler.
For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.